Amud Bet 2B. In English, it's 2B2. 2B2. 2B or not 2B? 2B2. Now, just to review for a moment the conclusions that we have gone as a result of our study in the Gemara so far. The Gemara has focused on the implications of an unusual formulation at the beginning of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, you will remember, and you can look at it at B, Daf Bet Amud Aleph, just back a few pages where you get the Hebrew page. Dine mamonot bishlosha gezelot v'chavalot bishlosha. Dine mamonot, that is to say monetary law, judgments made in monetary law is bishlosha in the court of three. Gzelot v'chavalot bishlosha. And matters of theft or matters of damages are also in three. So the Gemara immediately says, why does it tell us both of this? Because in fact, Gzelot and Chabalot are just examples of Dine Mamonot. Gzelot, thefts, and Chabalot, damages, are examples of monetary law, because when it comes down to the payment of something that the court will decide, that payment will be a monetary payment. And it doesn't matter. If it's a matter of damages, for example, let's say you damage someone else's body. Well, we know as a matter of law that your body is not damaged, though the literal meaning of the text is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. We don't understand it to be that way. The law in the Talmud is that there is always just monetary compensation for all damages, be they damages of body or be they damages of external property. Okay? So in all these cases, these in fact turn into monetary cases, because there will have to be a court that will sit and that will render a judgment in monetary terms. So why then does the Mishnah say Dine Mamonot Bishlosha Gezelot V'Chavalot Bishlosha? It's saying the same thing twice. Okay, that was the problem that was first posed by the Gemara. So the Gemara answers in fact in two ways. First way that the Gemara answers is that, well, you should just understand that it's as if you have a colon after the first shlosha. Dine mamonot b'shlosha. The law of monetary issues is in three colon. What do we mean by that? Colon. Gezelot v'chabalot. Okay? So that's one way of understanding it. It could be that. The Gemara does not conclude that, however. The Gemara concludes something somewhat different, because the Gemara understands immediately that if we say that there's a colon afterwards, and where it says Dine Mamonot Bishlosha, that applies to Gzelot and Chabalot, to thefts and damages, that in fact we're leaving out a whole area of law. We're actually leaving out two areas of law. Those two areas of law are halva'ot v'hoda'ot. Or first is hoda'ot v'halva'ot. That's the way the Gemara says it. Hoda'ot are admissions, and there are a variety of conditions where there might be an admission. If somebody has taken a loan, somebody's taken a loan now, and somebody else heard that the person who received the loan says, just in passing, oh, by the way, I got a loan from so-and-so. Okay? And then comes a later time, the man who gave the loan says, I want you to pay me back the loan. And the guy who received the loan says, I never got a loan. There is a person, however, there may be witnesses to the fact that there was a loan in the first place, but those are called witnesses. And that's what we're referring to when we refer to halva'ot. That is to say, the formal making of a loan where there are two witnesses who will, as it were, sign on the dotted line for that loan. That's called halva'ot. Hoda'ot is where there has been an admission to somebody else in the meantime, even though there wasn't formal witnessing, there was an admission to someone else. Okay? You admit that I had that law. So that's the meaning of hoda'ot. Okay? Admissions. In fact, hoda'ot are in the Torah itself, in the 22nd chapter of the book of Exodus. That is the classic source of hoda'ot, and I just want to read that to you because it's going to become relevant. That there are two areas of law, both of which are in the 22nd chapter of Exodus. They're in Parashat Mishpatim, and there will be some relation between these two areas of law. The first one is the area of custodianship. Someone is a custodian, right? When a man gives money or goods to another for safekeeping, this is Exodus 22:6. When a man gives money or goods to another for safekeeping and they are stolen from the man's house. Okay? So, somebody has money in safekeeping, goods in safekeeping, and they're stolen from his house. If the thief is caught, he shall pay double. Makes sense. It's a theft. Generally, in Jewish law, there's a penalty for theft, which is a payment of double. If the thief is not caught, the owner of the house shall depose before God. Oh, that's what we saw last time. The thief is not caught. Now, so the guy says, the gold watch that you gave me, it was in my house. You didn't pay me anything for it. So remember, where you have a custodian who is a not paid custodian, he in fact doesn't have any particular responsibilities unless it's an issue of negligence. So if he says someone stole it from me, in fact we will want to know whether he was negligent in watching your watch. Okay? Because if he was negligent, then you might have a case against him. Because you didn't pay him, he had no particular duties toward you, except that we do put a limitation on negligence. Okay?
Does he have to prove himself?
Well, here's this is going to be the problem. How are we going to derive any proof from this? Right? We don't have any way to prove it. There is one good method that you use, however, where there are no objective facts that you can really turn to. So we don't find the thief. So he says there was a thief, but we can't find a thief. All right? So what's the next best thing we can do? We can bring the guy to court and ask him to take an oath. Most people don't want to take an oath and lie in court, particularly when you're dealing with a religious system where not only lying in court is against the law of the state, but it's also against God. Right? He will take an oath in God's presence. So, that's what. If the thief is not caught, the owner of the house shall depose before God. Depose before God. Here, let's see what it says in Hebrew. Im lo yimatzei ha-ganav v'nigrav bal habayit elei Elohim. So it doesn't say he shall depose. It says the bal habayit, the one who owns the house, shall come close before Ela Elohim. Now, we saw last week that Elohim means two possible things. Either it means God, or it means a court. Okay? Im lo shalach yado b'malechet re'ehu. That means that he has not put his hand on his friend's stuff. Okay? So he's got to come to court, and he's got to do something, he's got to make some kind of a statement before God that in fact he hasn't done it. Alright? So from that we learn that at least as far as this text goes, we see the word Elohim there, which could mean a court, could mean God, that the person has got to do something, he's got to go before the court in order to prove his innocence. Al kol davar pesha, al shor, al chamor, al seh, al salma, al kol avada sheyomar, ki hu zeh. That was the problem. For any matter which is a matter of, let's see how they translate it here, in all matters of misappropriation. That's not what Pesha means, but in the context, it could conceivably mean that contextually. I'll call them our Pesha, and then here it's fleshed out. I'll shore it for an ox, or for a donkey, or for a sheep, or for a dress, a piece of covering, or for any loss. Asher yomar ki huze. That was the problematic part of the verse. Asher yomar ki huze. It's very, I don't know how to translate it. Asher yomar ki huze. The English here says, where one party alleges this is it.
Agreed with.
Well, all of these are possible. It could be the English is right, it could be that you're right. But this is an odd phrase appearing in the middle. So there's something about this. This is it. And usually in the Talmud also, where the Talmud makes reference to a biblical statement where somebody says, this is it. If the rabbis understand it also as this is it as opposed to that is it. There is some emphasis taking place when you say, ki huze, huze, as opposed to something else. But what would the other else be? That's not clear. I'm not going to say what it is because I don't know what it is, you don't know what it is, the text doesn't know what it is, and the Talmud doesn't know what it is. So it's just left uncertain. This is it. The case of both parties shall become before God. That's clear. All right, they come before God. He whom God declares guilty shall pay double to the other. Now, keep in mind that in this discussion, therefore, of the custodian, we had mention of El HaElohim, all right? El HaElohim. And then we had not only one mention of Elohim, but we had three mentions of Elohim. And we learned last week that as a result of the fact that we have three mentions of Elohim, in fact, that means that a court consists of three people. Where it involves a matter, which is in fact a matter of monetary law, which we see it is here in the case of the custodianship. Okay? All right. So that's where we learned a few facts. We learned that the court that is the court for Dinei Mamonot, for monetary law, is a court of three. We learned that from the fact that there was a threefold repetition of the word HaElohim. Okay? So that was, the Gemara didn't go into that in any detail. It sort of passed by it, made mention of it. It will come back to it later on in the Gemara. Yes?
I asked a question about the concept of being deposed before God. It seems to me that people swear all the time in court, before Congress, okay, it seems to me that people don't have any trouble, okay, you know, falsifying themselves. So my question is, okay, in the society that was present, okay, when the Talmud was written, was the assumption that falsifying an oath have greater weight or greater penalty than it does today?
Two things. First of all, I'm not sure I agree with you.
Okay.
Because I know, having been recently on jury duty, that in fact, the first thing that's invoked is an oath. But you do take an oath.
Yeah, sure.
You do take an oath, okay? My assumption is that even if in our society we still have that, that it has a certain degree of power, that it does have power, and that it may not have absolute power, but it does have an unusual level of power, and the fact, my proof is that it's still done, and I would submit to you that if it didn't have any meaning, it probably wouldn't be done. Number one. Number two, I think that the supposition that you make is probably correct, that there are probably times where these things are taken more seriously than at other times. And yes, I think it would be quite true that any society that would be considered to be a religious society, I would think that religious statements and religious statements of fact that are placed before God would have a fair amount of strength. So I think it's true on both levels.
But was society more religious then?
Well, I think that...
I guess that's the basic question I'm asking.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe I didn't use the words. And I'm never comfortable with those words, more religious. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Whether they put on tefillin more, whether that means that they're more religious. I'm not sure about that. But that there is a fear of God. That there is a fear of God. I would even say that in this country, And I don't know this from personal experience, but I only know it from reading literature. It appears to me that there was a certain fear of God in the 19th century, which there isn't in the 20th century. It's just the nature of society. You read Nathaniel Hawthorne, okay? Read classical American literature of the 19th century, and the fear of God plays a major role in the literature, plays a minor role in literature today, I would say. So, you know, that's as much speculation as I'll allow myself, but I think that there are times where that is more central to life than at other times. Which is not to say that even in those times which are where it's not as central, that it has no significance. I think it does have significance. Okay? Yes?
You were just saying that the punishment is to pay twice the value of the goods that were stolen from the house. So let's say somebody gave me something that was $10 that you can buy on the street. He comes and gives it back to me. I said that somebody stole it from my house. He takes me to court. I'm ready to pay the same amount that I gave. I'm not saying that I didn't steal it. I mean, somebody took it. I'm ready to give him the value. Why I need to be paid twice?
Interestingly enough, the law says twice because the law wants to discourage theft. It not only wants to encourage you to return what you have stolen, which it does want you to do, but in addition to that, it wants in general for people to think twice before they will steal something.
I didn't steal it.
Oh, you didn't steal it?
No, I didn't steal it. I wanted to pay the equivalent of to go to the market and buy exactly the same. Why I need to pay twice?
Only if you stole it do you have to pay twice.
Yeah, but there is no proof. He claimed I stole it. He has the opportunity
The court will have to decide.
He can get twice.
The court will have to decide that. If you stole it or not, that's a matter for the court to decide. That's why we have courts. Okay?
Well, I might not even give him even the first time. I might come.
When you go to court, it's possible you could win your case if you say you didn't do anything like that.
You could win.
Okay? You hired Dan.
You
hired Dan.
You understand what I'm saying?
That's the nature of law. That's the nature of law that, in fact, if you could prove your case, you might actually succeed, whether you're right or wrong. And I dare say sometime in your career, Dan, Milt Bearer, all of you guys must have somehow heard of a case where the wrong guy won.
Not that I was sure.
It was on the other side. Okay. Yes, sir.
Just to remind myself, the reason that we brought up this case in the first place was to argue why it had to say Dinei Mamonot as well as just Gezeilot v'Chavolot, right?
Correct. We're looking for something, and we haven't yet found it, about Hoda'ot and Halva'ot, that will be different from most cases of Dinei Mamonot. Till we get there, however, we're going to learn a few basic things about Dinei Mamonot. Among them, we have just in passing seen that it is in the area of the custodian that we have mentioned for the first time of the Court of Three, right, that we see.
But I thought that it's in the case of the custodian where it mentions the Court of Three. And that, I think, is considered a case of gezeilot, which is why it says that if the Mishnah just said gezeilot v'chavolot v'shlosha, you might think it includes other cases.
Correct.
Because it's, and only saying that because it's the scriptural reference.
Correct. So this so far has nothing to do with halvaot, nothing to do with loans, okay? And remember, in the case that I gave you just a minute ago about hoda'ot admissions, I described that in terms of loans. Somebody took a loan, you heard about it, okay, and the guy didn't want to pay back, and the question was, is there any force to what you heard, okay? So we haven't seen the connection between the two yet. You're right. Yes.
I was just going to add to Ron, for a contemporary example, if you lose a book from the Columbia Library System, you must pay $100. The book could cost $20, it's irrelevant. They want you to be in fear of losing something from the collection. So there's a motivation to establish it.
And they will not accept if I will buy the book and give them the book?
No way.
No way.
Way.
They don't
no
want
way.
Your copy. They want the copy they want.
They, and correct, and they also want the fear of stealing from the library to be in everybody's mind who uses the library.
And it's in your there is computer law, so there's not a lot of running around. It's just to give you a contemporary
okay.
example of the same.
Very good.
If it was stolen and proven stolen.
No, it's on my ID, iPad.
Okay.
You
if it's found in someone else's.
That ends your problem. You can take that person to court, okay? But in the meantime, you got to pay.
I got to pay.
Correct.
I can't bring that book. I can't.
Let's go to now the loans. All right, so far we've established a little bit as far as custodianship goes. We know a little bit about monetary law vis-a-vis the custodian. What this has to do with loans is as yet, who knows, okay? In the same chapter of Exodus, chapter 22, in Parshat Mishpatim, a little later on, after we have discussed the custodian, there are, as is the usual wont of the Bible, all kinds of things are thrown in. In verse 15, if a man seduces a virgin, what does this have to do with anything? It's the way the Bible works. It brings in all kinds of issues of law. Whoever lies with a beast shall be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to a god other than the Lord alone shall be proscribed. So those are, you move from sexual things to matters of idolatry, prohibition against idolatry. Verse 20 then. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. The Bacchanata ethics. Okay? But a very strong, central ethical statement. You shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. If you do mistreat them, I will heed their outcry as soon as they cry out to me, and my anger shall blaze forth, and I will put you to the sword, and your own wives shall become widows, and your children orphans. Scary statement. Okay, but basically of an ethical nature. Now comes verse 24. So now chapter 22, verse 24 of Exodus. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, do not act toward them as a creditor. Exact no interest from them. If you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, you must return to it before the sun sets. It is his only clothing, the sole covering for his skin. So here, in verse 24, we have the first mention made of loans. First mention made of loans. And understand the context of the mention made of loans. It is introduced by statements about not oppressing the stranger. Immediately after the mention of the stranger is a statement about not ill-treating the widow and the orphan. Okay. Next verse is, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, do not act toward them as a creditor, exact no interest from them. Okay? So here we see that, in fact, in this society, loans were a known thing. People would loan money. But we see at the same time that loans have to be interest-free. Loans have to be interest-free. You're not allowed to take money for a loan. And it's not saying that necessarily across the board, because it does say, in kesef talve et ami, if you make a loan among my people. Right? So in fact, the law is different, loans vis-a-vis the outside. But as far as loans Jew to Jew, it is against the law to have to exact any interest for a loan. Right? Very basic idea in the law. We studied it at one point. One year we did study this concept. Correct? But here it is, right few verses after the law of custodianship. Okay? Now the law of loans is mentioned here, it's mentioned elsewhere in the Bible, but the law of loans might conceivably have something in common with a law of custodianship for a few reasons. One, because it's a monetary matter. So it's not unreasonable that it would. two is the notion of smichut parashiyot. Smichut parashiyot is the notion that if a subject, two subjects are discovered in, are discussed in relative proximity in the scriptures themselves, that proximity itself could be influential in interpreting whether one has any effect on the other. Okay, so that could be. All we have seen so far, however, is that the Gemara has said that there is a difference between hoda'ot and halva'ot. And there is a difference between that and the normal law of gezelot and chabalot. Okay? Now, it's with that background that we're going to pick up the 2b2, the left side of the page, the last few lines. My kasavar. Oh, I'm sorry. No, there was one other issue. We'll take it from the top of that page. Ulamai. From what aspect are cases of loans excluded? Right. How then are loans and hoda'ot, both of them together, how are they different from other cases that are monetary cases? If you want to set the possibility that loans and hoda'ot and admissions do not require a court of three. Bahama Rabbi Abahu, don't you remember the Rabbi Abahu said, Lidivrei Hakol, Ein Dini Hem Din. Shnayim Shadanu Dinei Mamonot, if only two judges sit in order to adjudicate a case, no matter what the case is, if it's any kind of a case of Dinei Mamonot, any kind of monetary case, the divrei hakol, everybody agrees, ein dineihem din. Whatever judgment they decide is invalid. Ein dineihem din. Okay? So therefore, the difference between loans and other issues which are monetary issues couldn't be the difference between a court of three and a court of two. Because we've learned here, according to Rabbi Abahu, everybody agrees that a court of two is invalid. So the difference couldn't be in numbers. So, we've got to find something else. Ela delo ba'in and mumchim. The difference is that when we get to a case of halva'ot and hoda'ot, loans and admissions, we do not require the same type of judges. We don't require mumchim. Now let's take a look at the Rashi. Remember, Rashi is always on the inside of the Talmud text. Inside meaning toward the margin. So here, if you go over to what for us is the right page, the page on the right side, because it's the Hebrew page. In fact, on that page, if you're looking in the middle part of the page, it's on the left side. It's on the left side. Go down, when the Talmud text itself stops, go down then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines down. It says mumchin is the first word in the line. It's in black Hebrew letters, dark text, black Hebrew letters. It says mumchin. Okay? Semuchim. That mumchim doesn't mean what it means in modern Hebrew, which is experts, but it means semuchim. Those rabbis who have received smicha, some form of formal ordination from the rabbis who came before them. And I mentioned to you last time that that is not equivalent to our notion of rabbinic ordination. Rather, it was a type of ordination that was continuous until the Roman period. And at that period, it was destroyed by the Romans. And although there was an effort made in the late 16th century to renew it in Sfat, it was never successfully renewed and still doesn't exist in our own time. So that what is referred to here as semicha is a type of empowerment which we no longer have. But there was a tradition of empowerment in the rabbinic period, which did exist. And go on with the Rashi. Smuchim v'natlu reshut minasi. They obtained their authority from the Nasi. The Nasi was the leader of the Jewish community. That is to say, why you still had a Jewish community that had a structured authority in it. The Nasi was the top person of authority in the community, as in Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince. Prince is not a really good term. Nasi is a better term. It refers to the person with the highest level of authority in the community. When you had that still functioning, and you had a Nasi, and you had courts that were appointed then by the Nasi, and then other judges who were appointed even by those courts, you had a system that functioned which no longer exists today. Okay? So when we say that there is a difference between the kinds of courts that function regularly in the area of dinei mamonot, in monetary law, and the kinds of courts that we permit to function in another area, which is in loans and admissions, admissions having to do also with the law of loans, there is a difference. We in fact allow people who are not ordained, according to the Gemara, to make judgments in that secondary area of law. Okay? All other areas of law, the people who make those judgments, who are members of the Batei Din, have to be semuchim. So the difference, as the Gemara says it, there are mumchim and there are shalom enam mumchim. There are the ones who have smicha, and there are the ones who are not mumchim. They don't have smicha. They don't have the ordination from the nasi, as it were. Okay. So that's the definition of joints. Any questions about that? Let's keep going. My kasavar. So now the problem is, why are loans different? We're saying that loans require a lesser level of expertise among the judges, or lesser level of authority among the judges. Why should loans be different? Shouldn't all the law that's monetary law be the same? So my kasavar. What does our Tana hold that's different about loans from other things? Kasavar Eruf Parshiot Katuv Kan. No, Ikasavar. Ikasavar. Left out the key word there. Ikasavar. If he holds the view that the mixture of scriptural sections is written here, Libai Nami Mumchim, then loans should also require ordained judges. Ve'i kasavar ein eruv parshiot katuv kam. But if he has the point of view that there isn't a mixture of parshiot here, shlosha lamali. Why do I need three? All right, I'm sure that's perfectly clear what I just said. I hope you're being honest. What in the world are they talking about? Okay, what in the world are they talking about? Very odd Gemara. There's a concept here that is crucial, but that is certainly not obvious. And that is the concept of Eruv Parshiot. Eruv Parshiot. Eruv is something that's mixed. Arbeif or Elarev, something is to mix it. Eruv Parshiot means that there's a mixture of Parshiot. There's a mixture of parshiot. Okay? Now, by a mixture of parshiot, it means that though two things may not be directly next to each other, they may not be juxtaposed parshiot, still the parshiot, the verses of the scripture, are first of all in the neighborhood of each other. They are in each other's neighborhood. The 22nd chapter here of Mishpatim, of Exodus. So they're in the neighborhood of each other. And it could also be argued for two further reasons that something in one part of the parsha affects something in another part of the parsha. One verse affects another verse for two following reasons. One, it could be that there are reasons simply of the oral law. There's a tradition. Remember, the oral law, the Torah Shabbal Peh, is a complex system of understanding the ramifications of the written law. The Torah Shebaal Peh occasionally has logical traditions. Occasionally it has judicial traditions in it. Occasionally it just has ideas that we learn from it, which are assumptions of the law. I'll give you another assumption of the law, which is not necessarily logical. For example, when it says, you shall bind them for a sign upon your hands, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. What does that refer to?
It's a filling,
right? How do you know it refers to filling?
Because the Egyptians did it.
That's how you know it's refers to filling. What kind of logic is that? The Egyptians may have done it, but it doesn't mean that we don't know. Maybe when it says that you shall bind them for a sign upon your hands, that they should be for frontlets between your eyes, that's a metaphor. When we say in English, for example, you should take it to heart, do we mean that literally? Do you mean you should put something on top of your heart? We don't mean that. It's a metaphor. Okay? It's a way of saying that you should take something very seriously. So I could argue to, on logical grounds, that to say that something shall be you shall bind it for a sign upon your hand, that it shall be for frontlets between your eyes, that's a metaphor. It's a way of saying you should take it very seriously. That you should actually put a box on your head and your arm? Who would ever think of that? Okay? But we know that that's the law. That's the Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Torah Shebaal Peh sometimes exists to clarify issues like this, which are beyond logic. We don't know. There's no logical reason to either say that something is to be taken literally or to be taken metaphorically, unless, in fact, we have a tradition to that effect. In this particular case, we have a tradition to that effect. So, to some extent, I'm saying that there are issues of the Torah Shebaal Peh which are based on tradition. This is a traditional way of understanding something, and it could very well be, therefore, that certain issues in the scripture, Eruv Parshiyot, for example, the fact that a few verses before something is said, particularly if that's something that is said is fairly difficult, if not impossible, to understand. Such as, what did I tell you before? Where the Torah says, Zeh, ki hu zeh, we couldn't understand it. Oh, well, when you can't understand something, especially when you can't understand something, and if you have a tradition that in fact the parshas, the verses, can have some effect one on the other, Erev Parshiyot is a way of understanding that that particular phrase, may in fact be relevant to something else. It wasn't necessarily relevant to the custodian, but Erev Parshiyot, those who accept the notion of Erev Parshiyot, rather have a tradition of the Torah Shebaal Peh, that in fact it's relevant to the law of loans. Now, I'm not arguing that this is totally logical, but I'm saying that the context of it is logical, just as I argued before about filling. Okay? You have a series of traditions here to explain things that are otherwise very hard to explain. And if this goes back, you know, to the very essence and beginning of the law, this is a legal tradition of interpretation. Okay? In addition to that, may also be that logic, so far I haven't made a logical argument, I'm making a formalistic argument, now I'm going to make a logical argument. I might be able to argue logically that there is a logical difference between a custodian and a loan, somebody who gives a loan, okay? There's a real logical difference between them. Because in both cases, if there is a denial, in fact, the methodology of countering the denial is probably going to be different in these two cases. Because when a person takes a loan, if that person were to deny the fact of a loan to the person who gave the loan, I would like to suggest to you that it takes a level of chutzpah to do that, which is different from the case of the custodian. Let me give you the following example, just to show you there's a difference between these two cases. Very recently, I was waiting in line at an airport. Maybe waiting in a long line, you know, for security. So the lines are always much longer than you can believe that they will be. So somebody is in front of me and remembers that she forgot something somewhere. So the lady says to me, she says, could you watch my bag for a minute? So for a minute you say to yourself, I'm on the security line. Somebody asked me to watch a bag. You know, should I be doing this? You look at the lady, she's perfectly decent, you know, normal looking person, not a person that you suspect when you look at the person. And you could be in, yeah, we immediately, my reaction is, I profile the lady immediately. Seems perfectly reasonable to me. And I realize, you know, when you do this, I say, the last time it happened to me, you know, it could be me, it could be her, I'll be a nice guy. What does it take for me to do this? Okay? I'm a custodian, an unpaid custodian for this lady. In fact, I have no obligations to her, although maybe if I were totally negligent, namely if I walked away from her thing, I would certainly not be nice. I couldn't tell you in the American legal system whether she would have a case against me. But I can tell you it wouldn't be very nice at all. Okay? That's the case of the custodian. Let me give you another case. Case number two. Same lady says to me, could you loan me $10? You know what I would do? Nothing. I wouldn't loan the lady $10. Where do I know this lady from? Suddenly she comes and asks me to borrow $10? I would never loan money. But interesting. I was willing to watch her release, though it could have had a bomb in it. Certainly it could have had a bomb. In fact, I realized to myself that being a custodian is different than being somebody who loans money. I wouldn't have taken any interest from her had I loaned her the money so she could get a hamburger. It wouldn't have been a case of interest. It would have been probably an unusual case of kindness. Would have been an unusual case of kindness. Okay? Now, with that in mind, I want to read the Rashi here. I want you to read the Rashi. Okay? Eruv kika, ikasavar parshiyot ketiv. All right. This is just below the mumchim one. My kasavar tana didan dimatinu. Okay, I kasavar eru parshiyot ketiv kan. If the tana of our Mishnah assumes that there is a mixture of parshiyot here. A mixture of parshiyot again now will mean that what is written about the custodian has a legal impact on what is written later about a loan. Okay? De'ik elamandi amar behagozel etzim, because there is a point of view in the chapter called Hagozel Etzim, which is in Baba Kama, the Talmud in Baba Kama, that says, Shehaparshiota ketuvot be'ela hamishpatim. That point of view written there in Baba Kama says that the parshas, namely the verses that are written in Ela Mishpatim, in chapter 22 of Genesis, of Exodus, Mu'ur Bavote, they are mixed in, they're mixed together. There isn't a narrative sequence that is absolute to them. Shiesh Mikra Katu Befarsha Zo, there is a verse written in this parsha, She'eino Yachol La'amod Ba'ela Miparsha Acheret, which cannot be understood by itself except in reference to another verse in the parsha. Kugon Asher Yomar Ki Hu Zeh, such as what we just pointed out before, that phrase, ki hu ze, ki hu ze. Alright? Yomar ki hu ze, the one who says ki hu ze, that this is the one, or something like that. This is the one. Alright? Shmot 22. The Alfina mine, we learn a general principle from those words, ki hu ze, those three words. The general principle is, mode bin mitzata ta'ana yishava. That the person who makes an admission, a partial admission, shall be brought to an oath. The person that makes for a partial admission shall be brought to an oath. I'm not going to explain this yet. I'll explain it in a minute. But let's go on with the Rashi. Shekatav b'shomer chinam, because it is written in relation to the custodian who is not paid. That's what we're reading about now. Lav ashomer chinam kaye. Even though that phrase is written in the context of the unpaid custodian, it has no relevance to the unpaid custodian. It has no relevance to the unpaid custodian. The shomrim af al pi shelo hodu mimitzahat, that a shomer, a custodian, even though he does not make a partial admission, chayabim lishava, he is required to take an oath. The hoda'a miksata ta'ana parashat in kesef tal ve'ka'e. The admission and the need to take an oath for a person who makes a partial admission is relevant only in the case of loans. Now, what's the difference? We have two cases in front of us. One is a case of the custodian who is unpaid, the unpaid custodian. The other is a case of loans. Okay? In fact, the oral law, back now to the oral law. The oral law says that there are two types of oaths. One is a case where you can say to a person, you have to take an oath. And it doesn't matter whether the person says, well, I admit that I was partially involved. It doesn't make any difference. That person is required to take the oath. In fact, that's what's relevant to the unpaid custodian. Unpaid custodian is not paid for anything, okay? He's not getting anything from it, and is not, in fact, engaged in a particular act of chesed in what he is doing. He's not engaged in a particular act of chesed. So the assumption is that the unpaid custodian, I'm just sort of summarizing what Rashi is saying further on, the unpaid custodian probably might be willing to lie, might not be willing to lie. We really don't know. We don't know. So we cause the unpaid custodian to immediately go take an oath before the court. But as far as loans go, the very fact of a loan itself is different from the custodian. In fact, the person who gives the loan is engaged in an act of tremendous chesed, more than I was willing to do for the person in the line.
What's the difference between the two?
I'm explaining to you. Don't you agree that there's a difference? Didn't you think when I told you this story that there was an absolute difference between watching somebody's suitcase and giving them $10? That's the difference. But it's different. The fact is that they're two different.
Why wasn't it chesed?
I didn't say it wasn't chesed. I said it wasn't the same chesed. Right? It's not the same. Simply isn't the same. Why do I emphasize this? Because, in fact, with the person who gave the loan, the person who has received the loan, it's an act of tremendous chutzpah to say to that person who gave you the loan, who was so kind to you, you never gave me the loan. Who has the nerve to do that? You may be right. You may be right. But generally speaking, people wouldn't do that. What would they do? Generally speaking, it's much more common. People wouldn't deny the whole loan. I'm giving you the logic of the oral law here. The logic of the oral law is that as far as loans go, people just wouldn't deny the whole thing. Keep in mind, we're not talking about loans in our time. We're talking about loans in their time where there's no interest. Right? So the person who makes the loan has nothing to gain from it other than being a nice guy. Right? He has nothing to gain. He can't get any interest out of it. He's not getting interest against the law. We just said that. Okay? So the chutzpah that it would take to deny that there was a loan is just, yeah, people don't do that. That's the logic here. However, less chutzpah is required to say, oh yes, of course you gave me a loan. You say you gave me a loan for $100 and it was only for $75. Okay? That's less chutzpah. People are more likely to make that kind of a claim than they are to make a claim that you never loaned me anything at all. Okay? That's the difference between the two. Oh! If that is the case, then the little piece of the parsha here which says, Im hu zeh, was that what it was? Ki hu zeh, ki hu zeh. Because that is it. That is to say, the whole thing that we're talking about, the whole thing, ki hu zeh, no, only a part of it. Only a part of it. That refers to loans. Kihuze, I did borrow money from you, but kihuze, it was only a part of the thing, alright? You say I owed $100 and it was only $75. Kihuze. Oh, what the oral law has done has taken something out of context. That's erev parshiyot. It's taken something out of context, either based on the formalistic notion of what the oral law is, or some of the logical realities of, in fact, dealing, which I tried to argue on a logical basis here, the bottom line is that if you accept the notion, and it's not necessarily that it must be accepted, because the Gemara says, "E kasavar eruv parashiyot," if you have the point of view, and it's not necessarily, you may not have that point of view, but if you have the point of view that eruv parashiyot makes sense, katuv kan libay nami mumchim, then you are saying that the law of the unpaid custodian, in those verses, affect the law of loans. If that is true, you accept that one affects the other, then we already know that in the law of the unpaid custodian, how many judges do you need? Three. So how many judges should you need in a loan case?
Three.
Oh, we have a problem. The Gemara has a problem. If you accept the very notion of the Eruv Parashiyot, then if you're going to carry it to its logical conclusion, there should be a requirement of three and a requirement of three. Oh, it's a problem. All right. Now next, ikasabar ein eruv parashiyot. But if you do not accept the notion of eruv parashiyot, the mixing of parashiyot, kan shlosha lamali. What proof do I have that there have to be three in the first place? Okay? What proof do I have that there have to be three, and certainly in the case of the loan? If you say that there's a direct connection between the two, then I know the three from the custodian. So it's got to apply to the loan. Right? If there isn't a direct connection, how do I know that there even has to be three? This is classic Gemara. A little complicated. But the Gemara, so if I know this, then I shouldn't be able to know. If I know this, I should be able to know that. Okay? All right. Then the Gemara concludes. Le'olam kasavar eruv parshiyot katuv kan. There is no question about the fact that the writer of the Mishnah assumes that there is eruv parshiyot. There is eruv parshiyot. The two are related to each other. And from the perspective of logic, it makes perfect sense that there should be required three ordained members of the court, both in the area of monetary law in general, illustrated by the custodian case, and in the area of loans as well. Logic should require them in both cases. But the fact that we do not require ordained judges, mishum de Rabbi Chanina, is for another reason. It goes according to the point of view of Rabbi Chanina. Diyamar Rabbi Chanina, divar Torah, from the perspective of the Torah, echad dine mamonot de'echad dine nefashon. This is a slightly different area of the law. I can let a lot of areas of the law tonight. According to Rabbi Hanina, as a matter of Torah, the law of monetary law and the law of capital cases should be the same as far as drisha and chakira. Drisha and chakira is the laws of cross-examination. Right? You have in our legal system that if somebody appears in court, the other side can always cross-examine that person. Okay? And what you do as a result of that, if a person is a witness, you try to undermine the credibility of the person as a witness. Right? You show that maybe they're not thinking entirely straight, or they thought that they saw something and they didn't really see something. So according to the halakha, the requirement to have drishan chakira should apply equally to all cases, be they monetary or capital cases. Okay, go ahead. Shinemar nishpat echad yelechem. Leviticus 24:22. Okay, I'll start before. If anyone kills a human being, he shall be put to death. So that's a capital case. One who kills a beast shall make restitution for it. Not a capital case. Right, that's a monetary. There's monetary payment. Right? Life for a life. I don't know what that means. Probably it means in the human case. Okay. Or else it means that the amount that you pay has to be an appropriate amount of restitution. Okay? Anyone maims his fellow as he has done, so shall it be done to him. Fracture for fracture, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. We know what that means. It doesn't mean an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It means that it has to be just monetary compensation. Alright? So there, we're in chabalot again. Chabalot is damages. So we've covered now the areas of dinei mamonot and chabalot, gezelot and chabalot. The injury inflicted on another shall be inflicted. He who kills a beast shall make restitution for it. But one who kills a human being shall be put to death. Well, there, it's pretty clear. So if you kill an animal, restitution, that's dinei mamonot. Next one, kill a human being, you're put to death, that's a capital crime. Okay, dinei nafashot. Next verse. You shall have one standard for the stranger and the citizen alike, for I am the Lord your God. The first it says, you shall have one standard. The Gemara understands that you should have one standard not only to be for the citizen and the stranger, which is what the verse itself says, but again, these are juxtaposition of parshiyot. The previous verse put together dinei mamonot, monetary issues, with a capital issue. The Gemara therefore learns that just as in a capital case, you need to have cross-examination of witnesses, so you must have capital in a monetary case cross-examination of witnesses. Okay? That's what the Gemara learns from these verses. However, Rabbi Hanina says something different. Rabbi Hanina says that from the perspective of the Torah, you need drishan chakira, cross-examination of witnesses, in both monetary and in capital cases. However, uma ta'am amru dine mamonot lo ba'in and drisha b'chakira. What is the reason that in rabbinic law, as opposed to Torah law, the rabbis legislated that we do not have cross-examination of witnesses in monetary cases? Kadesh lo tin ol delet bifnei lovim. In order to not close the door before people who will loan money. Now, what does that mean? That means that if I loan you money, I loan you $100, okay? I want to be sure, ultimately, that even if you deny that that ever happened, or you say that I loaned you $50, that I have some recourse in court. Okay? When you cross-examine witnesses, it's a tough business. It's a really tough business. You can put to question a witness's credibility fairly easily. Well, if that's true, you know what? I'm not going to loan you money. If you're very easily able, if the law actually gives you the right to cross-examine a witness, then I become less willing to go out of my way to loan you money. After all, again, understand we're talking about loaning money where there's no interest. Right? I'm loaning money because I'm a nice guy. Take a chance with you because I'm a nice guy. I think it's a good thing. You want to go into business. I want to loan you money to go into business. But I got to have some recourse in case it doesn't work out. If the law itself works against the probability that I would able to have reasonable recourse, then the first thing that happens is I don't loan you money. Because I have nothing to gain from it. Right? I just don't want to have too great a liability when I do it. That is to say, I want to be able to have a court case. It's for that reason that the rabbis decided, and they have that power. The rabbis have the power to disqualify issues of money that the Torah itself allows. So the Torah itself allows Rishon Chakira, the cross-examination of witnesses, and the rabbis have the right to disqualify that. They have to disqualify it. And it is for the sake of not closing the door before people who will create loans, because it's good and healthy for society to have plenty of capital moving in it. And in order to encourage the free movement of capital, the rabbis don't want a system of law that will discourage people. Okay? So that was the reason then why, even in cases of Drishan Chakira, they allowed loans to take place without that stipulation of the law. The rabbis allowed the court that would examine a case to be a case that was not a court of ordained people. Because the more difficult you make it, the less likely it is that loans will actually happen. And loans are for the general health of a society. So that is the reasoning here. The reasoning ultimately is that loans and admissions having to do with loans, it's all issues of loans, are really dealt with separately in order to create an environment which is a healthy environment for the moving of capital. And so that people will want to invest. Because if people will not want to invest, then the society, everybody will suffer as a result of it.
A loan is not investment.
Okay. Well, a loan is, it stimulates investment. Because if you want to go into business, probably the best thing you can do is get a loan. I had a visit yesterday from the head of the Jewish Free Loan Society here in New York. A friend of mine, Shana, who is the fantastic lady who's executive director of the Jewish Free Loan Society, talked about a number of things and something we're going to do here in Or Zalul. And she gave me a statement that she had written, which explains the purpose of the Hebrew Free Loan Association. Hebrew Free Loan Association. It's a very wonderful idea. It's based on this verse here in Parashat Mishpatim. And she quotes Maimonides. And Maimonides says that there are many levels of charity. One of the highest levels of charity is that you give somebody money and that person will earn a living from that money. You don't give them just a handout, you give them a means to make a living. So she goes on, she says, as these are discussed, the highest level of charity is where we have $100. That $100 is used to help Reuven start a business. As soon as Reuven's business is going, what does Reuven do with the money? Pays it back. Right? The same $100 then goes to start Shimon's business. When Shimon is in business, he takes the $100 and he gives it back. Right? Repays the loan. The same $100 goes into Sarah's business. Sarah wants to go into business. So from $100, we started three businesses. That's the whole idea behind the Hebrew Free Loan Association. Okay? So that is the value of having capital that's readily available in order to stimulate the economy. And the loan is crucial to that, particularly when the loan does not involve the person in having to pay interest on the loan, because that's something else. Once you have to start paying interest on the loan, it's a different story. Okay?
Is buying a piece of the business interest?
No. Buying a piece of the business is not interest. And ultimately, in fact, in the Talmud, when you get a very complex economy, when you get a very complex economy in a way, you need to have something either that is interest or is like an interest. And in fact, the rabbis eventually create a notion of investment in someone's business, which is different from interest. So in fact, it is different. Any of you who are involved in law in the Muslim world, where a tremendous amount of law goes on today, partly because of the tremendous power of oil in the modern economy. All contracts written, let's say, for Saudi Arabia are essentially written with these issues in mind, where the Muslims are likewise prohibited from earning interest on a loan. So there is a question of investment. It's a question of investment and payback on investment, and it's not a question of loan, but the contracts have to be written with that in mind. So, yes?
This lady that you met, if I need to borrow $200, 100 from her and 100 from a bank, can I use, instead of taking the money, use the $100 as collateral for the 200?
Will the Hebrew Free Loan Association give you that money?
I don't want her money, I just want her
Probably not.
I'm not taking anything from her, so now she can immediately help me and somebody else at the same time. Why she couldn't do it?
Because they also don't want to put their money at great risk.
But if she gives me the same risk?
No. She will, first of all, not give you money just because you asked for it.
Nobody gives me money.
Well, maybe even if she knew more about you, she wouldn't give you money.
She should.
But, okay. I think you answered your question. Okay. Yes, Barry.
I'm still having difficulty with the concept of authority. In the Torah, we start with God as the authority. God allows Moses to judge. Moses judges. Then with Jethro, we have other people who are the heads of the community who were selected. But that's all flowing from God to Moses to those people in a very linear way. Then we have the priests who eventually seem to inherit some of that through Aaron, but now that is no longer the basis of magisterial authority. All of a sudden, the Nasi appears as a completely new authority without a very obvious connection to the original line of authority.
That's a good point.
And now we're even moving further away from that because we're now breaking off to the unordained magistrate who has authority from no place that we've, at least to this moment, learned where that authority comes from.
So this is a very confusing thing for me to trace back, because I think all legal systems, all legal judgments, ultimately their integrity rests on the community's perception of the legitimacy of the authority. And I don't know if this is, you know, from the Romans, the fact that the Hasmoneans were not favored, but it's very confusing to me how you're keeping that communal acceptance through the fragmentation.
Ron, could you, there's a, behind Richard, we're really behind Charlie, third row down is a collection of the Mishnah. That's it. There should be a volume there. Probably it's the last volume of Nezikin. The last volume of Nezikin. Probably more than one volume of Nezikin. Give me the Nezikin bet. Okay, let's see if I can find it there. Okay, thank you. Let's see if I can have the right one. Here we go. Thank you very much. We're a good team. I want to read to you the first Mishnah of Masechet Avot, the tractate of Avot. And this comes toward the end of the Seder of Nezikin. Remember, Nezikin means damages, and Sanhedrin is more or less in the middle of the order of damages. Okay, so you get the smaller Masechtot come toward the end, and Pirkei Avot, which we're familiar with, is a part of that. So one of the questions is, why is Pirkei Avot involved? Why does it appear in the Seder of Nezikin? Here's the reason why, and it's the answer to your question. The Mishnah begins as follows. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moses received the Torah from Sinai. Umnesarah Yehoshua, and transferred it to Joshua. Yehoshua lizekenim, and Joshua to the elders. Uzekenim laNevi'im, and the elders to the prophets. UNevi'im misaruha laAnshei Knesset haGedolah, and the prophets passed it down to the men of the great assembly. Hem amru shlosha devarim, and they sent them the following. The following Mishnah Bet is Shimon HaTzadik Haya Mishiarei Knesset HaGedolah. Shimon HaTzadik was among the last members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. He said the following. Okay? The next Mishnah. Antigonos Ish Socho Kibel Mishimon HaTzadik. Right? Antigonus from Socho received the law from Shimon HaTzadik. The reason I'm reading to you is this is the answer to your question. In fact, the reason why the Tractate of Avot begins the way it begins is to make it clear that there is continuity of authority. There is continuity of authority. And that goes all the way down to Hillel and Shammai, and all throughout this rabbinic period, they have continuity of authority. Okay? So, in fact, that piece of it makes sense. That fits. You are pointing to something that is radical now. What is radical is the notion that there is the possibility of having authority which is not ordained authority. That is radical. And I can see two reasons for that, two obvious reasons. One is within the system itself. And that is that the system itself at a certain point may find the need to create additional authority. The Torah itself gave the right to the judges to rule in their own times. And therefore, even within this system, you have the possibility that you could create new lower levels of authority. I don't think that's against the system, since the system allows the people to do that. Okay? That's one answer. Second answer is along the lines of where you were going, I think, and that is perhaps we can understand this because there was a breakdown of authority. That in fact, the system that we are reading about here, the system that we're reading in Sanhedrin, really dates from a time after the Hadrianic persecution. Hadrianic persecution is about 130 Right? The mission itself is the year 200. So by the year 200, in fact, though you have a nasi, you may or may not really have a functioning authority. It's not at all clear the extent to which that is a functioning authority. Certainly, by the time you get to Babylonia, you don't have anything like that anymore. Okay? So it could be that we're seeing reflected here the historical reality, which does undergo some traumas in roughly the period which is just before the period we're reading about. We're reading about it post-trauma. Okay?
I have this question. Since it's the season, I'm going to raise this issue. When Jesus was tried in Jerusalem, he was tried by a Jewish court and condemned to death. But they did not carry out the sentence. They turned him over to a Roman court, which then took under advisement, apparently, the ruling of the Jewish court, issued their own sentence.
It's actually the Easter story.
Pardon me?
The Easter story, not the Christmas story, but there is a connection.
Yeah, yeah.
same party involved. Same party involved.
I'm backing into
it. Okay. Right.
So I'm wondering whether maybe there was something like that going on.
You're talking about sort of the same thing I was just referring to. In Roman times, in fact, we know that the rabbis had no authority as far as carrying out the dictates of a court in a capital case. They didn't have that authority. It was the Romans who had that authority. So, and that's a case in point that you're describing right here.
And civil cases?
Civil cases, not so clear. Civil cases, not clear. My hunch is that there was rabbinic authority in civil cases, but not in capital cases.
Well, I would imagine maybe a big shot gets ruling against him. He goes and appeals in the Roman court.
It could be.
Do they have the right to actually try a capital case? Or
who?
The Jewish people?
I don't know. Because the only evidence I have is the Talmud. And in fact, the Talmud, most of what we are reading, again, the mission is the year 200. Right, that's 200 years after the period you're talking about almost. So we really don't know when you are reading some of this material the extent to which it is reflecting the reality of the period 200 years before, a fantasy of the period 200 years before, or a reality that was commingled with another reality. There were two of them. There was a Roman reality and a Jewish reality, and only seldom do you read about the differences between the two, even in the Jewish literature itself.
The Romans killed all the rabbis. How could they try capital case?
No,
well, I'm saying the rabbis, certainly after that point, there was a break in ordination.
The time of Jesus.
But that wasn't the time of Jesus. That's the year 130. That's the year 130. From the period of 130 on, then, in fact, there's a break in the ordination tradition. All right, there's probably a break. I can't say for absolutely sure because we have read the stories about you do have Yehuda's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, but it's quite clear that you don't have the same structure after that period as you have before.
Certainly
after the year 200, you don't have any of that structure anymore. You don't have any of the ordination. The ordination doesn't exist anymore. You have something like it, but it's just totally different. It's totally different. You have some continuity of the tradition, but you don't have courts that are able to sit that way. But what we are reading about is really something different. We are reading now that in order to promote commerce for the good of society, you really need a second level of judiciary, which is a more open judiciary, and it's not necessarily of the same level of authority. It could also be argued, if it's not of the same level of authority, it's not of the same level of expertise. Okay?
Just a comment and then a question. The comment is, there was an article in the Times within the last 2 weeks, very beautiful story about a rabbi in, Atlanta? Who had a Jewish congregant who wanted to remain anonymous but gave the rabbi money that he should give out interest-free. It's to members of the community and pay it back whenever they could. And it was so the Times reporter interviewed the donor anonymously, didn't know the name, because that's also part of the, isn't that part of Rambam's discussion about charity, that the highest form is that the receiver does not know who has given him the charity. Okay. This was not really charity. This was interest-free loans.
Interest-free loans.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
What goes on here in the city of New York, which is one of the reasons I was meeting with Shana, is just something extraordinary. We have a system here in the city of New York, run by the Jewish community, that most Jews are unaware of. And therefore, we were, between the two of us, I'm working from the radio, and we're going to do something here in Oy Zarua, and she's going to have other congregations do it, because they're celebrating their 120th anniversary this year. 120 years we've been doing this in New York City. And it's an extraordinary thing, and realize we have a lot of immigrants, both Jews and others, in the city. And the Hebrew Free Loan Association also loans to non-Jews. It's interesting. That's also not generally known. But it's something that we will talk more about in the coming months.
I have a question. From the text, but not exactly on this point, why is the Talmud so comfortable saying that there is Torah law? It's not an interpretation of Torah law, but it's Torah law, and they're saying, we're not going to follow it. We're going to do something else. Because we think it's a good idea to do something else, so we're going to do something else. Why is that?
There's a whole lot of Talmud devoted to that question. That's a question in the Talmud itself. And there are certain principles in the Talmud that the court, rabbinic court, is given the right to be mafkia. Mafkia means to annul something of a monetary nature. Rabbinic courts have the right to make that annulment. That gives them, in fact, general rights in all areas of monetary law to change the law, which is a right that the rabbis never took to themselves in other areas of law. They don't have it in ritual law. They don't have it in family law. They have it only in monetary law. Only in monetary law.
Is that derived from the Torah?
From the Torah. Oh, from the Torah itself. Of course, it's not obvious that it's derived, but they understand it as having been derived from the Torah. Okay? But I want to conclude by just the last line now here on 3A1. 3A1 is... Well, let's take the last two. Ela me'ata ta'u lo yishalmu. But if it is so that non-ordained judges are permitted by rabbinic sanction to try cases of loan litigations, if they erred, they should not be able to pay damages. Oh, this is actually raising another problem. We'll take that the next time. You see, all these issues really require a lot of background. So I would just hope that when you came in thinking about certain things, you've forgotten it in the last hour and a half. Isn't it refreshing to suddenly have to think about something completely different?
January 3rd is our next class.
The next class is January 3rd. January, Wednesday, is it the 3rd? That's the Wednesday after New Year's, okay? New Year's is on a, maybe the 4th. New Year's is on a Sunday. Monday is a national holiday. This is that following Wednesday. Okay? Have a wonderful vacation, and Hanukkah Sameach. Have a great Hanukkah.